On today's show, we have an unbelievable interview with ex-NHLer Randy Moeller. He gets into embarrassing draft stories, World Juniors in the 80s, playing and protecting Hall of Famers such as Peter Stastny, Pat LaFontaine, and many more. We then get into our past weekends, including the UFC fights, how much money Nathan lost, and how jealous Kale was of Nathan. And as always, we give the people their shower thought of the day. Let's go.
I'm Nathan Baylor.
I'm Caleb Clouston.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Minimal Filter. Minimal Filter. Minimal Filter.
This amazing interview with Randy Moeller is brought to you by none other than Shoddy. But wait, same company, new ad read, so listen closely, we got some good news for you fans. This company is revolutionizing jewelry one Shoddy at a time. These necklaces are multifunction and one hell of a conversation starter. These incredible necklaces have a shotgun tool built into every single pendant. They will tear through beer cans and create a perfect hole every time for you to guzzle down your drinks. For everyone listening right now, we are offering a special discount code just for you. Use MFers20 for 20% off your next purchase at theshoddy.com. That's THECHOTY.com. They've got everything from the Canada design to a mullet man shoddy. Follow these beauties at The Shoddy on Instagram, and you'll see why you need this.
Yeah, I mean, you butchered it the first three times.
Oh, wow. It's been a while. Fuck me. I haven't spoken for like 2 weeks.
We won't get into too much. We won't talk too much here, but I mean, we just finished the interview about probably an hour ago. I mean, he was fucking unbelievable. He was really good.
It was so much fun.
He was really, like, I said this, like, right when we got off, he was so natural, right? Like, I mean, and there's a reason why he's in media now. I mean, he talks so well, and he's such a good, like, natural storyteller. I mean, we just asked, like, we'd ask him questions, like, you know, what was, like, playing back then, but then he would talk about it, and then he'd be like, and here's a story about that time, right? Which was, like, it made it so much easier for us, and it made, like, honestly, it made the interview a lot more fun as well, so.
Absolutely, and, like, I'll admit, right now, I was a little bit nervous before, because I don't know this guy. I didn't know him before, and he's an ex-NHL player, so it's kind of cool. I played hockey, you played hockey, so getting to interview an ex-NHL player is huge. But he was so, like, just, everything was just flow, and after, like, the first 5 minutes, it was like, shit, this is actually going to be a lot of fun. So,
yeah, he was a tough guy. Minutes. I mean, for anyone who, like, doesn't even, like, listen or, I mean, watch or played hockey, I mean, it's a really fun interview. He gets into cool stories about just being around that time, and, I mean, how different the lifestyle really was back then. Most kids our age probably won't know who he is, but I guarantee you all your moms and dads probably will if you guys ever watch hockey. So
absolutely.
Kale, do you have anything else before we send it over?
No, I got nothing. Just enjoy the interview and tell your fathers because they'll know him.
Yeah, tell your dads. All right. Without further ado, we are going to send it over to Randy Moeller. All right, we are pleased to welcome on an ex-NHLer who played over 800 games, racked up over 1,600 penalty minutes over a span of 14 seasons, and won a World Junior Gold Medal for Team Canada in 1982. He is now the Vice President of Broadcasting for the Florida Panthers and TV color analyst. It is our pleasure to bring on Randy Moeller. First off, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing in Florida right now?
Great, guys. Great to be on with your podcast. And yeah, I think it's a little warmer down here than it is in Alberta.
Yeah, you can't argue that for a second.
It hasn't been too terrible yet. We've had a pretty easy winter, but it's soon to come around the corner. I can promise you that much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So before we get into the more intellectual questions, there's one I just want to get out of the way. I need to ask. So your Hockey DB picture has some very, very thick chest hair that either looks like you shaved it to stop it before your neck. So two questions. Did you stop your chest there intentionally and not realize the jersey didn't cover it? Or is there a natural stoppage of the chest right below your neck?
I've been growing body hair since I've been about 7 years old. So maybe that explains why I was able to get into the bars in my hometown in Red Deer when I was 15.
No fake ID, nothing. Just walked right in.
No, you got what I mean, my 5 o'clock shadow starts at about 2:15 in the afternoon. So I've never, the only problem is now, guys, and you'll probably experience it once you get to my age, whether you can't grow any hair where you want to, but you can grow it everywhere else in your nose and ears and back and everywhere else. So
can't wait for those days. Yeah,
luckily we're not there yet.
Not there yet.
Yeah. So that's kind of funny. I wanted to start off with kind of a story that I kind of heard from when you're back in Red Deer, a story involving your mom's vehicle when you and a couple buddies might have taken it out before any of you had your licenses. So kind of tell us about exactly how that went down and how you found a way out of that predicament.
Well, my parents, we used to have a trailer and they would go out and park it either, you know, Pine Lake, which is close to Red Deer, Sylvan Lake, Buffalo Lake, different places. And they used to go out on weekends. And when I got to be, 14, they trusted my brother and I, Mike, the stay home alone and that. And my father, he purchased this old car. It was early mid-1965 Ford with the three on the tree and the whole bit. And he parked it in the back. And a couple of times he let me go out and drive it with him. And that's how basically I learned how to drive when I was 14. And that, and they went out camping one weekend and I had a few buddies over. And also there was this huge dance. We had friends that are up in Wetaskiwin, north of Red Deer. Yeah. They were having a huge dance up there. And we wanted to go there in the worst way. Of course, we had no way of getting there. And the temptation was just too much, just too much. And the keys were left on the dresser in my parents' bedroom. And we decided, well, me and three of my buddies, we decided let's go for a spin. And then we got brave enough after driving around the neighborhood for a while that maybe we should do a little road trip. And so we headed up to Wetaskiwin. Couldn't find the dance. We got up there too late. And we were driving downtown Wetaskiwin. And sure enough, we get pulled over by the police. So we spent the night, and the funny story was my father was an RCMP for a few years in Wetaskiwin and knew all the police officers there.
Yeah, every single one.
And so they were able to get a hold of him at the campsite and that. And one of my friends, Ricky Bowles, his father had to come and pick us up. And my father just made a phone call to a good friend of his that had a car dealership in Wetaskiwin and told him, just go pick up the car and sell the car. So that was the end of it.
Rid of the evidence.
Yeah, I got rid of it and that. And my parents were not too impressed, but it was about a year later. I was only 15. I was working construction in between playing hockey, and I had my own car without a license. I bought my own car and that, so I get back and forth to the construction site out east of Red Deer and that. So that, yeah, that's the story. There's many stories like that. I don't recommend it to anybody or anybody that's listening, but there's a lot of stories.
A lot different nowadays for sure. Like, I don't think that would be doable nowadays for any of us without our licenses. No. So
even in small towns nowadays too, there's always something that you can't do anymore that you could do 30, 40 years ago.
And the funny part of it was when we got pulled over and the police officer and another police car came. And of course they knew my father and they were walking back to the car. And of course we were just petrified sitting in the car. What are we going to do? What's going to happen to us? What? And they're killing themselves laughing. They're killing themselves laughing. So it was kind of a big joke in that. And I think they had a lot of fun with my father, teasing my father over their, their delinquent son.
That's awesome. So I guess fast forward 2 or 3 years from there, we'll get into your junior career now. And my first question would be, how did you manage to get over 400 penalty minutes in just 2 seasons? Cause that's unheard of nowadays, obviously.
Bad refereeing.
Yeah, we all blame that, I guess.
That's definitely what it was.
Well, I was one of the bigger guys and playing junior hockey and that was my style. It was that, and at the time, guys, you remember back in the early 80s, early 80s, and that, and leading up to my draft year, that was when they were just coming out of the Broad Street Bullies, the Philadelphia Flyers, and there was a lot of tough players that played in the NHL. So scouts are looking for, because they believe that's the way the game is going to continue to be played, which obviously we all know now that skill has taken over and those days are thankfully long gone, but they're always looking for big physical, especially right-handed shooting defensemen that was tough, that could fight and that. And I played into it. I mean, that was part of my, it was part of my DNA. It was part of my makeup. And I knew that if I played that style, that I'd have a good chance of possibly, you know, having a good junior career and possibly get drafted. I didn't know that I'd be drafted in the first round, but and like I said, obviously the game has changed now, and I'm just, it's amazed how the skill level of the players that are getting drafted, especially defensemen, all these the young defensemen that can handle a puck and lead the rush and, that's the exciting part. But back then that wasn't the case. If you were a 5'9" or 5'10", 160 pound defenseman, you didn't have a chance to make in the NHL unless you were really, really skilled and had a mean streak. But I'm just glad the game has changed.
Yeah, no, I mean, you look at guys, you could just take two guys from the same team. You could look at Cale Makar and Bowen Byram, like two unbelievable skaters who, I mean, yes, they obviously can protect themselves and they throw big hits every once in a while, but I wouldn't say either of those guys have a mean streak to them at all. So
no, and we just, and the, you know, with the Panthers, we just played against Vancouver Canucks with Quinn Hughes.
Oh yeah,
you know, Adam Fox with the New York Rangers, and that's the way the game's going now. I mean, I like to tell the story now, but towards the end of my career, because the game had started to change by the time I was finishing my career, and I was known as a stay-at-home defenseman. The only problem was at the end, the team told me to stay at home. So
took the term too literally, I guess, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Stay at home defenseman. Now you have to stay at home. So
not quite the same.
No.
We'll go back to quickly the World Junior.
Kids, I'm your eager beaver.
And I'm Mr. Grizzly.
If you love politics
or hate politics,
then have we the perfect podcast for you.
The True North Eager Beaver.
Incisive political commentary.
We keep you up to date
and give you the political and media literacy you seek
to help you
cut through the bovine fecal matter.
Facts first.
Sound analysis.
Sometimes I growl.
Sometimes I sass.
We impart civics and build community.
And we share some laughs along the way.
Being informed
and engaged has never been more fabulous.
Or sexy.
Catch us on the Dean Blundell Network.
Or on our YouTube channel.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Because democracy is something you do.
Juniors, I mentioned that in the intro. So kind of just kind of talk through that experience. I mean, not only what it was like winning gold, but also winning it with your brother.
Yeah, it was a special time in our lives. And there was a number of different aspects of that. And it's hard to believe for young people like yourself that are watching this podcast that back in the day, they didn't even televise the tournament. So a few of the games were on radio and that we were really that year, we won the gold medal. And I think that opened up a lot of eyes and it's become a very popular tournament, and the media and the fan interest really bolstered that when we won it that year. A lot of people don't realize that the tournament was split into two spots. It started in Winnipeg and then it ended up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a couple of games around Minnesota. We actually won and clinched the gold medal game in Rochester, Minnesota, which is an hour and a half south of Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And we played in front of maybe 1,800 fans. That was it. And we played a couple games. Yeah. And then now, of course, so, you know, TSN and millions of people watching and, you know, 15, 18,000 people in attendance at wherever they play the tournament. But the other thing was, yes, my brother Mike was, you know, I was able to play with him. That was a great feeling. He ended up scoring the game tying goal for us to clinch. Wow. His jersey's in the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto for that feat. And the last thing was my father, he and Troy Murray's father actually came to the tournament in Winnipeg and watched the first couple of games there. And when we beat the Russians on Christmas Day and that, so for my father to be there, that was a special time, and to play with my brother, and we had a great time. But at the time, guys, we had no idea, like the way the tournament is now and the media focus and everybody, you know, playing for Team Canada and that, we just got brought together and, hey, we're playing in a tournament and your name's on our list. Would you like to show up in Winnipeg? And okay, can my brother come? Hey, yeah, we're going on the team and that, and really had no knowledge of it, you know, because of the history of it now. now you talk like yourselves and kids that are 15, 16, 17 years old, or even younger than that, about playing for the World Junior Championship and represent your country. It's a special, special thing, just like playing for the Olympics. At the time, it was just, oh, it's just this tournament that they're having and that. But it was a great feeling, and I'm very honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, and sure. Wasn't it before, like, I think it was only a couple years before they changed it. So that way, like, before it was just the winning team of the CHL. Didn't that who represented? Did that change,
correct,
like, a couple years before you got chosen?
I think that might have been, guys, that might have been the first year that they actually didn't just take one team. They actually took an all-star team and a cross. Another side story that you guys will like this one. So we're getting ready to play our first game, and we hear that they're going to bring in a player, and they end up bringing in a player, Garth Butcher, who was a very tough and player and played for the Regina Pack Capitals and very tough, but he was a good player as well. And they brought him in, and right before the tournament, we had to cut a player. It was the Hall of Famer, Al McGinnis of the Calgary Flames. Yeah, imagine that.
Yeah.
Al McGinnis got cut, and he was so upset, and we were upset as well, and that. But kind of a footnote, you know, he ends up having a Hall of Fame career, yeah, and that. But he got cut and right before the tournament. So
that must have lit a fire under his ass then, and motivated him, because he had quite a career for himself.
Boy, could he shoot the puck? Yeah, yep. Chopper could really shoot that puck and that. It, you know, I mean, he said, I got to know him, obviously played against him my whole career, and excellent. And now he's a very successful part of the St. Louis Blues, you know, yeah, management, yeah, and that. He's done a very good job.
And it is crazy, too, how you mentioned, like, how big of a tournament the World Juniors is now compared to back then. Like, I'd say probably aside from the Stanley Cup, it's one of the most viewed, like, weekends or even days, like the gold medal game of all, yeah, of the whole entire year in hockey. And
yeah,
and like, it's not just Canada and US. Now you see the Finns, the Czechs, the Swedes, everyone's just getting better and better. And
yeah,
do you remember, was there any like big name Russians or Swedes or Finns back when you played that year that you remember?
There was Ruzicka that ended up winning the tournament MVP,
wow,
from the Czech Republic's the Czech team, and he ended up playing a number of years in Boston. But and then there was a player that played for the Czech team as well, Yuri Dudacek, that was the first round pick of the Buffalo Sabres, and unfortunately he lost his life. I believe it was in a traffic accident a few years after that. Other than that, yeah, I played. I mean, there was I think Esa Tikkanen I played against. There was a couple others. I don't think Jaromir Jagr was there. No, he was too young at the time. But there was a few of them. Risto Siltanen, I think, was with, yeah, Finland at the, right, time and that. But yeah, back then because in North America dominated the, especially Canada dominated the draft. You know, it used to be at one point, I think, well, my draft year, I mean, 80% of the players that were drafted that year were from Canada.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, and then you had, you know, 10 or 15% were American. And then you sprinkled in a few of the Europeans from Finland, Sweden, and what have you. At that time, it was impossible for any of the communist countries to come over legally, you know, I mean, and that until the Alex McGillney and, of course, yeah, Fetisov and
sneaking them
Larry Anoff, yeah, and all those that happened a few years later. So now the draft, as you guys watch the draft, I mean, it is wide open. It's worldwide. And so many countries are represented in the draft.
Yeah, no, and I think that's just has to do with the fact there was obviously like less resources back then, right? I mean, obviously there was a lot of countries that weren't legally allowed to come over, but I mean, NHL's team started realizing that there is a shit ton of good players over there, right? And what, well, does that make an impact? So,
okay, and then that leads me to another story from the World Junior Championship. Of course, you had Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic at the time, or I'm not quite sure. You had the Russian team that came over, and we're all in the same hotel. All the teams stayed in the same hotel, so like they had breakfast in one of the the function rooms from 8 till 10, there's the Russian team. The next door, there's the Finns. The Canadians are there. And then you'd have, you know, different times for the U.S. team and the blah, 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 and that. And I felt sorry for, like, especially the Russian team. Here's the team, and they couldn't do anything. I mean, we had, obviously, the freedom. We could go out and do whatever we want. There's a shopping center in Winnipeg right across the street. We could go. They weren't allowed to go anywhere. And I think it was a positive yet a negative. The Russians, especially at that time, it's unfortunate that they'd never seen food that was that delicious, that fresh, fresh fruit. They had bottles of Coca-Cola there and that, and these players, they were just hoard all this fresh fruit and six packs of Coca-Cola and take them back to the room because they didn't have an opportunity back in their homeland to have that kind. And then I think the food as well, the big breakfasts and the lunches, it was pretty rich for them. Yeah. And they're not used to that. I traded two pairs of, because I got a head up right before the tournament. I took a couple extra pair of Levi jeans, which they have no access to at the time. Right. And I traded it for one of those Russian fur hats, Russian players and that. And he was more thrilled at these $10 Levi jeans that I gave him than giving up the Russian hat. So
you still have it?
It kind of. It's back home somewhere, back in Red Deer. Somebody's got it, but that just shows how far the game and the world has come.
Oh, absolutely.
But when you tell people that, you tell the story like that, guys, people are like, really? Oh yeah. This was a communist country, that was representing and that, unfortunately, these players just did not have any freedoms at all. And we never saw them unless we were on the ice with them. Or, walking past as they were going from the breakfast, lunch, dinner room back to the rooms. Never saw them.
That's unbelievable. I mean, it kind of just shows like the reality that they lived in. And then obviously the control that the team and coaches still kept over them when they were even here.
Yeah. Yeah. It really was. Yeah. And the equipment that they had, these old skates and old gloves where guys with had no leather on the inside of their gloves and their these old sticks that were all taped up and probably had nails in them and that. It really was. I felt bad. At the end of the tournament, I remember when we tied the Czechs to win the gold medal, right after we won it, the Czech team just came over and they're motioning. And that I gave my gloves, I gave my stick, and they all like it. Yeah. It was like you were giving them new cars or something, and that because they wanted to take something back home that they could remember from the tournament.
No, that's crazy. So, well, I guess we'll kind of lighten it up a bit here. But I mean, how big was your ego after you won the World Junior gold? Like, did you find that it? I mean, obviously, you got to stay humble being a kid from just Red Deer. But did it like boost your confidence for the rest of the year?
Yeah, it did. It did, guys. It did. But then again, it wasn't as big a tournament as it is now.
Yeah, that's true.
And we won it. We won the gold medals. And my brother and I were recognized at a reception back in our hometown in Red Deer, which was very nice. And that. But I mean, 2 days later, after we got back, my brother and I were back in Lethbridge playing for the Lethbridge Broncos in junior. And we were, finishing out the year and getting ready for the playoffs.
It's a quick transition, hey?
Yeah.
And then so after junior, you're drafted by the Quebec Nordiques. Did you know how crazy the French fans were out there? Or like, was it something you weren't used to, all those crazy fans?
Well, being in the province of Quebec, I mean, watching the Montreal Canadiens and know how rabid their fan base was, watching TV and on Hockey Night in Canada, I knew about that. But going to Quebec, it was kind of like the weak sister kind of a thing as far as the Nordiques. I mean, it was the Montreal Canadiens are such a huge brand, and they had such a strong team. And when I joined the NHL, I mean, Montreal still had Larry Robinson and Guy Lafleur. And I mean, they were such a dynamic team and brand. And the Nordiques, though, were up and coming. And It was amazing, the rivalry. So yes, was I a little surprised? Yes, I knew that the fan interest and just the crazy interest in the teams and the Battle of Quebec and that, but I didn't realize until I got there. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, I played 7 years in Quebec, enjoyed every minute of it. We beat them a couple of times in the playoffs. They beat us a couple of times. We had the big war there the 1 year and the Valentine's Day massacre. I was a part of that.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
No surprise, but the rivalry was very good. I just did an interview with a author that's writing a book actually on the Quebec Nordiques. And he asked me if I would love to see the Nordiques back in the NHL. I'd love to see them because the fans are so knowledgeable and so passionate there that it would be great. I just don't know how they're going to do it here in the short term.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think if you look at, I mean, you use Winnipeg as an example, like, yes, it's a smaller city, but I mean, the reality is the fans are there and I mean, the following's there. So I do think if you look at, I mean, everyone's saying Arizona, if anyone does move, it would be them. But I do think that if they did decide to move, I think Quebec should be number one because of the fact like they're going to have the following and it will not be difficult for them to sell seats at all for like years.
Well, there's just the only thing is though, it's a little bit more than that. There's the corporate sponsorship and there's a little bit more involved than just filling. Oh, there's no doubt that they'd fill every seat, every game, but there's a little bit more to it than that. And, but I, like I said, personally, I'd love to see them back in the league somehow, some way, and someday, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Especially like you said, with them being the little sister, I mean, Montreal gets all the bigger ones in that area anyways. Yeah. So, we'll just kind of keep with Quebec quickly here. So, I mean, what's kind of one of the craziest stories you have when playing in Quebec? I mean, outside of hockey, whether it's like, I don't know, a dressing room story or, I mean, look, like inner, what's the word I'm looking for? Just engaging with fans at a local bar or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about it, because Quebec City is fairly small, and when I was there, and it was the only professional sport, I mean, and there's no baseball, football, or anything like that. We were it. So it was kind of a blessing a bit that whenever we went anywhere, like myself, you're always recognized. Recognized. It'd be like, you know, in Calgary, when Jerome Iginla and Mike Vernon and Joe Nieuwendyk and those guys, they couldn't go to too many places or around town in Calgary and not be recognized. Everybody recognized them. So it was the same way in Quebec City, but the fans were always very respectful, very kind to me and that. I'll tell a quick story. You asked for a kind of a funny story. So it was my first year. And of course, I don't speak too much French, but I'm taking French lessons, which the team supplied after practice. So I'm taking these French lessons. So the PR director comes to me and our games used to be on if we weren't on Hockey Night in Canada, CBC, it was called Quatre Saisons, Four Seasons. So they asked me and they said, "Hey, Randy, you think your French is good enough to do an interview in the first intermission? It will be in French." I said, "Sure, why not?" You know, 19 years old or whatever. Yeah. So I go and do the interview. And they gave me the questions in advance. And so I was practicing in the afternoon, but I still wasn't, guys, I wasn't very good. So anyways, back then in the locker room, they used to have the TVs up in the corner and that. And my defense partner my first year was Moose DuPont, Andre Moose DuPont. I was 19. He was like 36. So I do the interview and I come back to the locker room and I was so proud of myself that I finished it. And I walked in and I said, "Hey, Moose." And everybody was all standing, sitting around. And I said, "What'd you think? What'd you think?" And he goes, "We couldn't understand a damn word you said." But the reason I tell that story, guys, is, and I've told it many times, is because I tried. And as we all know, you guys know up in Canada, I mean, the French culture and the French people are very proud of their language and their culture. Mm-hmm. And because I tried, I could do no wrong after that.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was, they loved it. And looking back now, I'm sure they couldn't understand a word I was saying. I was just blabbering stuff in French and that, but they liked it. And that, as long as you give the effort there and you have a good attitude about their language and their culture, you'll never have a problem.
Awesome. Yeah, I honestly, I know probably like five French words, so I'd be in the exact same boat. But yeah, it's almost like a respect thing. As long as you tried and they saw that you were at least kind of
absolutely. And you know what? Unfortunately, guys, there were so many players that came through while I was there that did not like the experience, really accepted the French and the culture and everything. And they wanted out and demanded trades and that. Mm. I never did. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my time there. And, you know, to be able to play with the Stastny brothers, Dale Hunter, Michel Goulet, it goes on and on. Dan Bouchard was there. I'm actually so old that one of our goaltenders when I first got there was John Garrett.
Yeah,
Chi-Chi. That's been a longtime analyst for the Vancouver Canucks out in Vancouver. So yeah, he was one of our goaltenders in that. But to play with Dale Hunter and that. But I was the youngest guy in the team by a long shot, and I was the only rookie the first 2 years. So it was difficult sometimes. You know, you get a little homesick even though you're playing in the NHL, because really after practice and after games, where am I going?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah. So, anyways.
And you mentioned how obviously hockey was a lot tougher back then. In 85, so I guess about 4 years into your career, you guys made it to the conference finals and played against the Flyers, which included some of the hardest guys to play against, like Tocchet, Dave Brown. So tell us what your mindset was like going into that series and the series itself. Like, how was that series?
Well, we were flying high because, we'd won the first, one or two rounds, and then you had to go against the Flyers, and that Dave Poulin was a big part of that as well. What I remember about that series was obviously the disappointment that we lost. We started the series in Quebec. We won the first two games. We're in Philadelphia and we had a lead in the third period, and it's not like it is today, and we keep going back. Peter Stastny, our best player, breaks a blade. It broke. Remember those old tuck skates that we used to have? He broke it. So it wasn't like today where they could just swipe things out and
30
and
seconds.
Yeah. They had to take the hole and take the rivets out and that. We missed them for about 10 or 12 minutes. They actually did it pretty quick. But during that time, the Flyers came back, overtook the game, won the game, and they end up winning four straight against us. And that was disappointing because we really felt that we had a good team to go to the Stanley Cup Finals that year, but unfortunately we were unable to.
Yeah, hockey's a game of momentum, as they all say. I mean, and you can just use that as a basis. I mean, it took them 10, 12 minutes to kind of just get the momentum for the series, and they went from there.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter Stastny at the time was one of the most dominant players in the game. And to lose him, I mean, it'd be like nowadays, like the Edmonton Oilers losing Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl for a period in a real tough, tight game. It's going to make a difference. It's really going to make a difference.
So that kind of leads into my next question. So based upon your almost 1700 penalty minutes, did you find like it was to like protect guys like Stastny or like Brian Leetch when you were with the Rangers? And kind of like, was it one of the things you planned before a game where you're like, oh fuck, like I'm probably gonna have to go with this guy tonight, or I mean, this guy's out there, or was it more like reactionary?
Yeah. And I didn't consider myself a heavyweight, unfortunately, but a lot of times I was lined up against heavyweights, whatever I like to say, I was in so many fights, whatever, I didn't win too many of them and that, but I knew what my role was and to play tough and be tough against, try and clear in front of the net. Those were back in the days when you could cross check guys in front of the net. Obviously now you can't do that anymore, but protect your teammates and that, but I never consider myself a heavyweight. And there were a lot of heavyweights
back then. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. We used to go into Edmonton and they would have Semenko. And if they didn't have Semenko, they would have McSorley and these guys. Oh my goodness.
Kind of scary dudes.
Yeah. And then you go to Calgary and they had Tim Hunter and Jim Poplinski and oh my goodness. And then you go into Vancouver and they had Garth Butcher and Daryl Stanley and Gino Ogic. And it seemed like every team carried three or four really tough players.
Yeah.
And that you don't see that anymore.
Mm-hmm. No. Who would you say was the toughest that you had to fight that or ever fought?
There's a number. I mean, I played when Bob Probert and Joey Kosher were in Detroit. They didn't call them the Bruise Brothers for nothing.
not Chris a bad Nyland, nickname to have.
Yeah, Chris Nyland was very tough going up, and especially the rivalry and playing against him for almost 7 years. And then we ended up being teammates and good friends. We both played for the Rangers at the same time. That was a little funny in that. Every team, Brown in Philadelphia, they had Craig Berube was in Philadelphia at the time, and then in Washington as well. And that, it goes on and on. You guys are giving me bad memories now, thinking back and that. But yeah, there was a lot of tough players back then.
Yeah. On the internet, which we all know is always 100% correct, it said that you had 79 fighting majors. 12 of them, which were against Boston, 3 of them against the Flames. And I'm glad you brought up Tim Hunter because he was actually my junior coach in Moose Jaw. So I'm wondering if you actually ever got to fight Tim.
Yes, I did. And I didn't realize it. It did not go very well. And especially when I used to come out and play Calgary and Edmonton, and you know, I'd have my family there, my parents and family and brothers and sisters and friends there and that. And the one time I had to square off with Tim Hunter and I forgot that he's lefty and it didn't end very well, guys.
It was crazy.
Down goes Moeller. Down goes Moeller.
The amount of stories he had too about like just that era of fighting. I think he fought McSorley like 20 times or something.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Those are you talk about the Montreal Canadiens Quebec Nordiques rivalry. I mean, the Edmonton Oilers back in those 80s and that, when they each of them had not only the great talent, offensive talent on each team, and obviously with Gretzky and Messier and that, but Calgary had a very strong team as well. But they had all those tough guys and that. You know, you talk about, and I end up playing with Joey Kosher as well, and he's a good friend of mine, and he heads up the Detroit Red Wings alumni. But it was, I think, his first year. And we went in there. I was with the Rangers at the time. And I had no idea who he was. I had no idea. And we bumped. And next thing you know, the gloves are off. And he swung and hit me right here and split my helmet. And I woke up. This was in the first period. I woke up halfway through the second period on the trainer's table at Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. If he would have hit me anywhere in the face, he would have killed me. But he hit me right there in the helmet.
The most solid part.
Yeah. And Joey Kosher was, he really sacrificed because his hands are like hamburger now. He used to, when I played with him for the Rangers and he would get into the fights, we'd be busing back to Westchester from Madison Square Garden or wherever we're going. And the trainers would put a great big 5-gallon bucket full of water and ice. And he used to just dunk his hands in the ice and for an hour at a time because he had such swollen hands, whatever. And many surgeries later, that's one of the reasons why he had to retire. But what he did and sacrificed for the Detroit Red Wings and the New York Rangers in his career or whatever, that's quite a sacrifice for some of those players. You don't hear about that anymore.
No. Yeah. And we've talked about, a lot about the difference in lifestyle, obviously, like back then. I mean, the playing style.
It is your favorite girl. That's right. It's the Allie Mars, the one and the only. Everyone else just ain't me. I am the host of Welcome to Mars, a lifestyle podcast where nothing is off the table. I have come a long way from sex and dating and have transformed the new vibe to all things lifestyle. We still talk sex, but I'm more interested in the journey, where people have come from, how they made it, and where they're going. Subscribe or follow to a brand new look and a brand new era. Welcome to Mars.
Subscribe or follow on Apple, Spotify, Google, or at theallymars.com.
Because even with the new look, I'm still that same bitch you love to hate.
Else, but like kind of go, let's go into like the transition into like the lifestyle. So, I mean, back like nowadays, you got your cool downs, your protein shakes after the games. I mean, was back then it's like more of a like, let's shower and then go grab some beers, or like kind of just explain the difference.
Well, my first year in the league of the Quebec Nordiques, I mean, we had 12 guys on the team that smoked. So, and smoking was allowed in locker rooms. So, every game, there'd be a 24 pack or two of O'Keefe's there. And you look back and you can, if you see some of those old interviews, you'll see guys after the game, like even like Guy Lafleur, they're interviewing him. He's having a cigarette and, you know, he's sipping on a Molson and having a cigarette and, you know, yeah, we played well and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. You don't see that anymore. And I think it's good, but that was the culture. That was the lifestyle back then. Guys nowadays, I have the utmost respect for NHL players and pro athletes in general, how well they take care of themselves and why not? Guys, the money that you can make and the careers are relatively short. For every player that plays 1,000 games in the National Hockey League, there's 1,000 players that don't get to 20 games in the NHL. Put that in perspective.
Yeah, that's an unbelievable.
You know, there's so many guys that only have a cup of coffee or they get their original contract and maybe they play a year in the minors. Maybe the second year they get called up in a few games. And then if they don't cut it, you know, they're off in the minor leagues or have to go to Europe or whatever. So I really do have the utmost respect for players nowadays and how they treat their bodies. And I know our athletes here in Florida with the Panthers, they get the best of the best. We have trainers and coaches and that skill coaches, mental coaches, nutritionalists, physiotherapists, chiropractors, you name it. But there's high pressure. And I think everybody realized because there's 15 guys that want to take your job and would love to be making $3-5 million a year. Absolutely. As a 21, 22 years old. So you can understand how serious these players take it. Maybe a little bit more than when I played.
Yeah, just a little bit. And I think that as an attest to like why the game is probably the best it's ever been, like all around, you look at the skill wise and just the speed in general. I mean, I think you could argue that it's the best it's ever been. Obviously, some people from your generation might argue otherwise, but I truly believe like the balance of skill and you got like, you still have like the fights when it's needed. I mean, when a game's kind of going sideways, you still have guys still standing up for their teammates. So I think, I mean, that just is indicative of just how well the players have taken care of their bodies. So.
Yeah. And that's the way, I think that's the way it should be. I tell stories and people don't believe me. I get drafted in the first round of the Quebec Nordiques. The first 3 or 4 years that I was even playing in the league, I'd come home at the end of the year. I'd work 6, 7, 8 weeks of hockey school. That was my summer money. I mean, do you think NHL players right now have to work 8 weeks of hockey school in the summertime?
I do not think so.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that.
They can retire after 3 or 4 years nowadays.
The money's so much greater now, and it should be. It should be. I mean, they're world class athletes, and they take care of themselves and the show and the skill that they provide. I think it's right, but it was a lot different back in the early '80s, mid '80s.
Yeah. So I guess towards the last 2 or 3 years of your career in the early '90s, that might have not quite been when that culture kind of started to change. But one of your last years, you played in Buffalo with some greats. You had LaFontaine, McGillney, Andrechuk. Yeah. Your goalies were Hasek and Fear. Just talk about what it was like playing with those guys, and also like who was the biggest character out of those guys on your team, or just in general.
Well, you don't forget about Dale Hawerchuk.
He was there as well. Well. Yeah,
absolutely.
And, you know, Mike Ramsey on the fence. Doug Bodger was there. I mean, my defense partner at the time was Peter Svoboda, who had a very good career as well. Very good, talented defenseman. It was a lot of fun. And we had the characters. You talk about characters. We had guys like Colin Patterson was there. Davey Hannon. Wayne Pressly was there. Gord Donnelly, Donald Audette. And we had so many different personnel. Robbie Ray, Brad May. Oh, boy. We had a tough team, too. But, to play with Dominic Hasek, which, you know, we traded for him. Mm-hmm. And nobody had really known. I mean, he'd only played a few games with Chicago. Yeah. and Mike Keenan was there. He wasn't a big fan of his. So they made the trade and, you know, all of a sudden the Hall of Fame career later and what he did and for the Buffalo Sabres. But it It was special to play with guys like the talent of Howard Chuck, but LaFontaine and McGillney were just on fire. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely on fire. And Alex McGillney was really something special too. I got along great with Alex. He got along great with everybody. But here's a guy. He hated the practice. He hated to fly. He hated everything about the game, except the paychecks, you know. But I tell you what, though, when he stepped on the ice for the games, boy, could he fly. And he was in attack mode all the time. But it was kind of funny because he hated everything else about the game. And he really was fearful of flying. And that caused him a lot of stress and that and going on. And back then, when we did charter, we had these Air Ontario double prop planes that were just turbulent, like all over the place. Yeah. It wasn't pretty. And so many times and flying and living in Buffalo and having to go to Toronto and Montreal and Quebec and Hartford up in the Northeast and all these snowstorms and that. It's amazing that we didn't nosedive one of those planes, because they're going through those snowstorms at the time. Yeah. It was pretty white knuckle, that's for sure.
Yeah. So that team, I mean, we look at the record and you guys were around 500. Like, kind of what happened that, like, did you guys obviously expect to do a lot better than that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you know, you look back on like you're mentioning, on paper, we should have been a lot better and that, but obviously, I remember we won one series against the Boston Bruins, I think, and then we lost a series against the New Jersey Devils, and we went to, what, five or six overtimes, and it was Dave Hannon that scored the end up winning the game that lasted till like 3 o'clock in the morning, and then we had to go back to New Jersey, and we lost a real tough game and lost a series against the Devils. And that was heartbreaking because we really thought that was our chance to maybe go far in the playoffs, but yeah, it never materialized.
No, that sucks. So the one guy that everyone's probably waiting for me to ask about is Gretzky. You and him have almost identical stat lines. So do you agree that he is the best player of all time? Yeah. Or was there somebody? Okay, so I guess if you do believe so, who else was maybe kind of enough recognition?
I've said it for years, guys, and I haven't changed my tune. Wayne Gretzky is the greatest player to ever play the game.
Good.
He was not the most talented, though, that I've ever seen.
Who was?
Mario Lemieux.
Yeah.
Mario Lemieux was too. He was unbelievable. And that's no slight on Gretz. And Wayne is great a person, and what he's done to grow the sport, especially in the States, and what he did and what he continues to do, representing the game of hockey. The greatest saying that I've ever heard in my life, the greatest saying was from Wayne Gretzky: everything I have is because of the game. Everything that I have and accomplish is because of the game. And I really respect that. And I feel I'm in the same position as well. Everything that I have is basically because of the game, and you have to respect the game, but he was, here's a quick story. So right when they're in their height, 86, 87, around that time, when they're just flying, and that Gretzky, Messier, and 200 and some points a year. So we go out, and I'm with the Nordiques, and we go out to Edmonton, and we start a road trip out in Edmonton. No, we start in Winnipeg. We won in Winnipeg, went to Edmonton, and all of a sudden, here we go, and it's a big, big game, and the Stastny brothers, whatever. We were up 5, I believe it was 5-1 with like 2 minutes left in the first period. We had shocked them. They just weren't ready to play, whatever. We're up 5-1. Dale Hunter takes a major penalty for high sticking, 5-minute high sticking or whatever. I believe we lost 11-6. We were up 5-1. We lost 11-6.
Yeah.
Paul Coffey had a goal and 5 assists. Gretzky had 2 goals, 3 assists. Messier, Glenn Anderson, and that. It was an onslaught. And then after that disappointment, we go down the road to Calgary, and I think we lost 4-0 to the Flames, and we never touched the puck. There was a lot of teams, guys, back in those years where a lot of teams went 0 for Alberta. They would go in absolutely. And just get slaughtered by the Oilers and that. But anyways, in saying that, you asked a question. I think Gretzky was the greatest player to ever play the game. Unfortunately, I never got to see, only on TV, Bobby Orr, big Bobby Orr fan.
Yeah.
And the utmost respect, obviously, Gordie Howe, Mr. Hockey. But Mario Lemieux was really some of the things that he could do with the puck and that kind of size, but he had the reach and the moves that he could make. But the other thing too, is they were surrounded, not at the beginning for Mario Lemieux, because the Penguins struggled for the first couple of years he got in the league, but they built a pretty good team and he had a lot of weapons around him. And of course, Gretzky with those Oiler teams, he had a lot of weapons and a lot of people around it and that, but two very special players that dear to my heart that have grown the game and we can, I'm very, very proud that I was able to play against them. I actually have a picture in the kitchen right here.
Yeah, I can kind of see it. Yeah.
Can you see over there that that's me and Mario Lemieux? A good friend of mine was a photographer for the Buffalo Sabres named Billy Whippard, and he took that picture and actually gave that picture me and Mario and at a game at the old Odd Auditorium in Buffalo. So that's one of my favorites.
That's awesome.
That. I've got a few of them around and that's here.
Yeah, well, this has been like absolutely phenomenal. So I'll just we'll wrap up with one more quick question. I mean, what do you think is one of the funniest or most memorable stories that you would have to have during your playing days?
I'll tell you the story with the day I got drafted. I got drafted at the Montreal Forum. I went down to Montreal and had dinner with my agent. We did a couple of interviews with a couple of teams, but I knew that if the Quebec Nordiques basically said that if I was available at pick number 11, I was going to be picked by the Nordiques. Okay. So we get up in the morning. Back then the draft was only one day and they started at 9 o'clock in the morning and then they went right till 8 o'clock at night, but it was done in one day. They do the first round. I get drafted 11th overall. I come out of the stands. I come down. The PR guy brings me over the table. You meet everybody and blah, 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 blah. Michel Bergeron's there. Maurice Filion, the general manager. Back then, and I don't know if they did it any other places, but up in the Montreal Forum, the old Montreal Forum, they had a very fancy restaurant that was upstairs. After the first round, they broke for lunch. Everybody broke for lunch. So we had a table, the whole table, and they invited me to go up and have lunch with the team. Oh, general manager, the coach, and all the scouts and everybody were all there. So I got my tweed blazer on with my tweed tie. Okay. So I go upstairs with these guys and we're all standing around and I didn't realize or whatever, but they'd already served the soup, cup of soup, and it was tomato soup. And everybody had a cup of tomato soup in this table that had probably 12, 13, 14 chairs around. This was ours. All right, let's sit down. They're going to serve lunch or whatever. So I go to sit down and my tie goes right into the tomato soup, right into the tomato soup. And I'm looking around and there's only a couple of us that have sat and the rest are starting to, make their way to sit down. And I didn't think that anybody was looking. So I took it out. And I wrang the tomato soup out of my tweed towel and I grabbed my napkin that I had, whatever, and I wrapped it around and I just shoved it down into my pants as far as I could to make sure. So if pictures later, once the draft's over, the my white shirt down by my belt buckle looked like I got stabbed. It was all red. It's like somebody had stabbed me or whatever, but very embarrassing. That was my draft day, but it was an exciting day. The other story that I tell about my draft day was right before the draft started. And of course, everybody, we're all nervous. We're all sitting in the stands and we're just like, oh, and that. And of course, when you're nervous, you got to go to the washroom, right? Yeah. I come down out of the stands and I come around the corner at the old Montreal Forum and I go into the bathroom and I'm standing at the stall and going to the bathroom and I look up and it's Larry Robinson, who was like this big. And I went like this and I stuck out my hand to shake it. Mr. Robinson.
Like right in the urinal?
Oh, yeah, right at the urinal. I shook his hand. He probably looked at me and went, what is this guy doing or whatever? He hasn't washed his hands. But I didn't give up that opportunity to shake Larry Robinson's hand. He was one of my heroes as well, of course, growing up and seeing him almost on a weekly basis on Hockey Night in Canada. Mm-hmm. So there's your two stories of wet behind the ears guy from the prairies when he got to Montreal. The first year, we go to this fancy restaurant and everybody's ordering Caesar salad. And I said, yeah, I'll have a Caesar salad. Can I get the Thousand Island dressing with that? I had no idea that Caesar salad came with its own dressing. I thought it was Thousand Island dressing. So those are the things that you learn when you're 18, 19 years old, guys.
That's incredible.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Randy. This has been absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
Well, it's my pleasure. Anytime. And good luck with the podcast and that. Hopefully you guys warm up and stay warm and enjoy yourself and good luck in school as well.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Awesome interview. Like we said, even before we sent it over, I mean, we knew it was going to be absolutely phenomenal. Kale, how'd you enjoy it?
Yeah, honestly, like we said earlier, it was so much fun. And obviously, he's had years of experience and he works in the broadcast industry, so you'd expect him to be a good speaker. But it was just like so natural. And every single story he said kind of just perfectly flowed into a new one. And it didn't seem like it was like we even had staged questions.
Yeah.
The naturals that could have
possibly. Yeah, it was honestly perfect. I mean, nothing was forced, and that's really what
not to tutor own
podcasting
home,
is about. I can't wait for the amount of people who are going to chirp us for saying, wow, these guys are just trying to be spitting chiclets.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be pretty funny.
Even though we're definitely going to tag spitting chiclets just so they can see that we're better than them now.
It was a very like chiclets-esque interview.
It was. Because like there's some serious talk, and then we'd kind of get down like a little. I mean, I made a couple jokes about his stat line with Gretzky being the exact same.
Yeah, we wanted to ask him if he was a boob or butt guy, but we kind of figured it wouldn't be too appropriate for the situation.
At the very end, just ruined the whole entire interview with that question.
Yeah, he just goes, fuck you guys, delete this whole thing. So that was Randy Moeller, absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. He mentioned after that he'd be willing to come on again, so if you guys like this one... we'll probably see it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let us know if you do, because if you guys do, like you just said, we'll definitely have him back on.
Yeah. I mean, that one story about the tomato soup, I mean, just imagine on your draft day. I mean,
I would cry.
You ruin your tie by dipping in tomato soup, and then you basically ruin the rest of your dress clothes.
Ruin the first impressions even, too.
Yeah, by trying to hide the tie.
Like, who's this fucking slob?
Yeah. Unbelievable interview, like we said. All right. Let's transition now. Kale, what'd you get up to this weekend?
Oh, I guess it's been a while. This past weekend, so a couple days ago, I work now, which I mentioned a few times, and I just basically do school and fucking marinate and eat food on weekdays, and then I work on weekends because that's all I have time for. So yeah, Friday, Saturday, worked. Sunday was my dad's birthday, actually. Big 5-1, so shout out to the old man. My mother and I went and, fuck, this was actually hilarious. We went up to Crossfield, so not far from Airdrie, to surprise him because he's coaching out there. And he didn't know we were coming. We get there. I sent him a picture of literally him on the bench right across from me coaching. He replies about second period intermission between second and third. He goes, where'd you see that? I'm like, what do you mean? So I'm like, took it. And then I didn't want to like text him again saying like, where the fuck are you? Like, hurry up. So he goes, you were at the game? I'm like, yeah, I'm still here. You in the parking lot? I'm with mom. 5 minutes later, he goes, we just fucking left. I'm like, oh, shit.
Your dad just left you.
He had no clue we were there. We were there to surprise him.
I don't understand where he thought you would have got a photo of him coaching then. I mean, it's not like he's coaching the NHL when there's photographers and shit.
Twitter's posting about him. Like, head coach Jason Clouston. I mean, realistically, it was his birthday, so maybe he thought like they posted a shout-out for his birthday. But no, it was just me.
Nope, just you being your dad's personal
photographer. It was only 5 minutes out, so we met him on the highway, but... It was all good.
Very cool.
It was funny. Other than that, how'd you...
It was good. I won a lot of money this weekend. First time in a long time that I've won money betting.
That's such bullshit.
I won many... Wow. I should have went with that. I won many fights on the weekend. I won 6 out of 6 bets.
You won fights?
I didn't win fights. I mean, I had no other choice but to bet on Francis Ngannou.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know who he is, just look up a picture and you'll understand why I bet on him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a freak of nature, and that just kind of leads me to a quick question, Kale.
Huh?
Would you rather fight Francis Ngannou or a silverback gorilla?
Gorilla.
Yeah,
for sure.
I genuinely think I'd be able to evade a gorilla. I think this, like, I wouldn't be able to, like, get away from this guy.
He's 6 foot. I think he's 6'5", 290 or something.
No, he's 245, like, but pure muscle.
I don't know why I said 290. Yeah, I was just trying to.
290 is like an offensive lineman in the NFL.
Still just fucking, he's boys. Huge. And, like, if you're a fan of UFC, you know that he has, like, the most powerful punch of all time ever recorded in history.
Yeah, no, he literally does. I saw the trailer for that Jackass Forever movie. He, like, punches one of the guys in the nuts, and
like, what the
fuck? I don't know, man. I don't know.
Even a flick in the balls hurts.
I wouldn't do that for a movie, man. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do that for... Actually, I probably have a price. I probably have a realist, like, $100,000, I'd probably do it.
Okay, sure, but...
Like a realist, like $1,000? No, I wouldn't be able to do that. I think $100,000 would be my price.
The fights were good though, because I was fucking man. Saturday I was working. I literally missed Saturday football. I missed Battle of Alberta, and I missed the fights because of work.
All Saturday,
3 till 10:30 shift, which is literally 3 till 10:30. Everything was just if you're a sports fan, you were in a heyday.
It was an unbelievable day of sports. Even if you don't like sports, I mean, I know a lot of people, friends of ours who are females. Dudes who don't even like sports, they said it was fucking awesome watching the fights and everything going on. So that was that. I won money, so it feels good. I haven't won money in a long time, and for me, my bank account was hurting, so it was nice to get like a nice little boost of a few hundred dollars.
Well, I'm glad you made money, because I haven't made money in a bet for like 2 months.
You were working though, so you were making money.
Yeah, actually true. I got paid today.
Yeah.
Fucking feels good, but I'll spend it all on rent. But the only bets I have left, I have two bets. They're all futures. I have I have only one left. The Bengals. I need the Bengals to win. Fucking Super Bowl.
To be unreal. I wouldn't mind if they did. That'd be
If they do,
awesome.
I win a lot of money because I bet it at the start of the year.
Yeah. That was basically our week. Like, nothing too exciting for the weekend.
Because school, man. It's too fucking busy now.
Yeah, life's busy nowadays. I just need to quickly rant about that fucking guy in our apartment building who works here. Mm-hmm. The one who looks like the dog with the hoodie meme.
Yeah.
You know what meme I'm talking about.
He has the world's smallest face.
His face literally looks like that dog.
Yeah.
But today I was working out in the gym, and there's a foot between me and the mirror. And I was on a bench, and like not enough room for a person, quite honestly. But this guy decided that he had to walk right in front of me and stand there to put tape on a wall that was to the right by 2 feet. But he decided that he had to stand right in front of me. So not only did I have to look at his weird-ass face, but I also had to smell his body odor mixed with cigarettes.
And again, not only that, but why the fuck wouldn't he wait 35 seconds?
He also could have asked, hey, do you mind moving quickly? But he just literally walked in this... I'd say he had about... Like, I'm not a mathematical guy or like...
Even though you're in accounting.
Yeah, I'm not a mathematical architecture or anything like that. But I think he probably had like 4 square feet to work with. Okay. In front of me that he had to stand in. I don't know.
Well, that is, I don't know. I mean, it's not a whole lot, but regardless, it's just like, holy fuck, man, personal bubble.
I just couldn't like, and with COVID too. Like I don't, the fact that you smell like cigarettes, man. True. Like
he's one of those guys who just, you know, for a fact hates his job and he wants everyone else to just know it.
I told you this when I was coming up from the gym, and I was like, he has that type of personality where he would blame everyone for where he is, like why he's doing maintenance in an apartment building. Mm-hmm. Like he would blame other people. Like it's fine to work maintenance in an apartment building, but if you asked him about his career, he would be like, oh, I'm here because I got fucked over by this guy and this happened.
Workers comp fucking couldn't pay me enough, so I had to get this fucking job.
Yeah, or some shit like that. He robs me the wrong way, that's all I'm gonna say.
But yeah, no, that's fucking, that was today and that was the weekend. I got fucking nothing else because my life's literally just been school this week.
Basically, whenever you've been busy and like I haven't had shit to do, I've put myself through the agony of watching Too Hot to Handle season 3.
I can. I said that for fucking season 2. I'm never watching that.
Yeah, I won't. I won't get into it into detail for the sake of anyone and everyone listening. But here, I have two major takeaways from this season or like the show in general. Mm-hmm. Number one, every person on the show for season 2 and 3 is so fucking stupid because the producers don't even change the set or anything.
No.
Like, you know what, they know exactly where they are.
It's all fucking fake.
It looks the exact same. So, number one, I hate how staged it is.
Yep.
And the second takeaway that I have, and this has to do with me, is compared, like, I actually have a pretty good personality. If I compare myself to any of those fucking dudes on any of those seasons, I think I have a pretty good personality.
Yeah, it's literally one of those shows where it's like, Because again, from Too Hot to Handle season one, which I actually didn't mind because it was like a new show, and I believe they didn't know.
It was right when COVID hit too, right?
Yeah, so it was like, you need something to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
But I believe, like, well, not that I believe, I know because I've seen it. Every single fucking person, whether they were out after like the first eliminations, whatever, they're rich now and they're famous. And these fucking dumbasses in season three, same thing's going to happen. It's just social media. They're going to get all these followers, all these sponsors, everything. And just because they're stupid.
Yeah. And it's just because they have the publicity, right?
And they have fake tits.
That's why they're on the show. The dudes don't.
Probably. They got some sort of injection.
Testosterone. They definitely all take testosterone.
They have decent bodies.
Yeah, there's a few guys who you for sure, like, just, that's
fucking
not
annoying,
natural.
Man. Like, they're not, it's supposed to be a reality TV show, but it's not real. The situations are nothing, that would never happen in real life.
And I'd say about, like, if you saw the new season, I'd say about half of them aren't even that good looking. Yeah. So,
well, fuck.
Compared to the first season was phenomenal. Yeah, so that's Too Hot to Handle season three.
No more fucking
If I gave it a rating, I'd just give it anxiety.
Yeah.
Nathan Kale's rating scales. I give it anxiety because obviously I did watch it, but I was just waiting to get to the end to see who, like, won. Yeah. I'll be honest. So,
and did you finish it?
I did finish it.
Well, don't spoil it because people probably, some of you fucking idiots are probably watching
this. That's today's show. We blabbered on enough. We had a really long interview, but it was fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's our lives right now. Nothing too exciting. We're really taking it easy with these lockdowns. There's not too much exciting things to do.
Life
sucks. So, Kale, shower thoughts of the day.
Shower thought of the day, which we're still going to have. We're never going to get rid of it.
Never, ever. I can go first here.
Sure.
Okay. So I was watching Avengers Endgame the other day for like the
1500th
37th time. I think
that's actually legit. Probably
37th
accurate.
Like, I think that's an accurate number. And I had a thought about like time traveling and like, oh, the theories people have about it. Mm-hmm. So you know how like they say if you make like a minor change in the past, like it's going to drastically change the future?
Yeah.
How come people in the present don't think they can have that same impact on the future?
Oh my God.
It's a deep one, right?
You're getting deep with that?
But like, I don't understand why, like if you like think about it in hindsight, just like that. Think about it. If you did a minor income, like, outcome in the past, like say if I threw a paper airplane at someone who didn't expect it before. Mm-hmm. Their theory is that things are going to drastically change in that timeline.
Okay.
But how come things I do right now, if I change my, like, how come that wouldn't change it? I don't understand.
Well,
that's a flaw in time travel. So
I guess you just never know, man. Just never know.
That's such a terrible explanation.
Well, it's, what
you just
else can
never
I
know.
Because if you,
you're supposed to be an expert on time traveling. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Let's just say once you get to like 10 years down the line. Yeah, so I can't even fucking. I'm trying to say something, but I can't even fucking think of the words because it's actually such a fucking weird concept. But I know what you mean. I'll just put it that way.
Time traveling is whack.
Sorry guys.
I don't know time travel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was good.
Mine sounds so dumb now. My shower thought.
That's why I went first. That's why I want to go first.
You want to hear it? Should I even say it?
Yeah, just go ahead. We can do it quick. We can literally say it and then end the show.
It's impossible to touch any reflection that isn't your own. I can't touch your reflection. I can touch my reflection because it's my finger. But I can't touch your reflection.
Crazy.
Right? Fuck you.
Yeah.
Whatever, man. Go fucking, right, guys. Go change your future, you fucking
Thanks for
asshole.
Listening to this interview, guys, if you made it this far. that's all I got. What do you want to say something before we sign off?
Love you guys. Bye.
Peace out.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, four-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.
Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. and Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.